Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really fundamental topic, speciation. You know, how new life forms actually emerge.
That's right. We're drawing heavily from a lecture by Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman to sort of distill this complex process.
Our goal is really to give you a shortcut, a clear path through the sometimes confusing ways biologists look at the creation of species.
Yeah, think of it as a toolkit for understanding evolution's engine. We'll cover the different definitions, the barriers, the mechanisms, the whole picture.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Dr. Hoffman defines speciation pretty simply, right? As the creation of a species.
Fundamentally, yes. If you picture that big phylogenetic tree, speciation is the node. It's the branch point where one lineage splits off into two distinct ones.
But it gets complicated fast. Dr. Hoffman brought up what he called the species problem.
Mm-hmm. It's a big one. Because even though species is like a standard rank and classification domain, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, there's no single definition that fits everything.
Right. And he pointed out why. Sometimes you have species that look, well, identical. You can't tell them apart just by looking.
But genetically or chemically, they're totally different. And yeah. Then there's the flip side.
Like us, humans. We're all one species, Homo sapiens. But look at the incredible diversity within our species. It makes a single definition really hard.
Exactly. So context really matters. Dr. Hoffman stressed that the concept you use often depends on, you know, what kind of organisms you're actually studying, bacteria versus plants versus us.
Okay, so let's unpack the most common one first, the biological species concept, or BSC.
Right. Dr. Hoffman laid this out clearly. It defines a species as a group of individuals that can interbreed in nature and produce fertile offspring.
Fertile being the key word there. Their kids have to be able to have kids too.
Precisely. It's all about maintaining that reproductive lineage. But, and this is a huge but that Dr. Hoffman highlighted.
It only works for sexually reproducing organisms.
Exactly. It's completely useless for asexual organisms like bacteria and archaea, which make up, well, most of the life on Earth, probably. So the BSC just isn't universal.
Which forces us to consider other ways of defining species.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Hoffman mentioned the oldest one.
The morphological species concept.
Yeah.
Basically grouping things based on shape, form, how they look. It's intuitive, but can be misleading, as we said.
Then there are concepts focused more on history and function.
Yeah, like the phylogenetic species concept. That one defines a species based on common ancestry. It's the smallest distinct group on a phylogenetic tree, like the very tip of a branch.
Smallest group sharing a common ancestor.
Yeah.
Got it. And the last one you mentioned.
The ecological species concept. This one ignores looks or breeding and focuses purely on the organism's role in the environment, its niche, what it eats, where it lives, its interactions.
So you pick the definition that best fits the question you're asking, essentially.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, now this is where Dr. Hoffman's lecture got really interesting for me. What actually keeps potentially diverging groups separate? The barriers.
Right. And he split them into two main categories. Things that happen before a zygote, that first fertilized cell is even formed, and things that happen after.
So pre-zygotic barriers first. These stop fertilization from happening at all.
Mm-hmm. They're the first line of defense. Dr. Hoffman outlined five main types.
What are they? Let's break them down.
Okay, first two are about separation. You've got habitat isolation. They just live in different places. Maybe one lives in water, one on land. They don't meet.
Simple enough.
Then temporal isolation. They might live in the same area, but they reproduce at different times. Think spring versus fall breeders. Time keeps them apart.
Okay, so space and time. What else?
Behavioral isolation. This is about courtship rituals. They meet, but they aren't attracted to each other. Dr. Hoffman used the blue-footed boobies example. If the male doesn't do the right dance, the female isn't interested.
Huh. Right. Specific signals.
And then there's a physical block, mechanical isolation. The parts just don't fit.
This was the snail example, wasn't it?
Yes. The clockwise versus counterclockwise shell swirl. Dr. Hoffman explained that this difference means their reproductive organs literally can't align, even if they try to mate. Amazing detail.
It really is. A whole species difference down to a twist. Okay, what's the fifth pre-zygotic barrier?
Gametic isolation. This is chemical. The sperm and egg meet, but they're incompatible. Dr. Hoffman mentioned sea urchins broadcasting sperm and eggs into the water.
Right.
Even if sperm from species A bumps into an egg from species B, the egg's surface might have proteins that reject that sperm. No fusion.
Five hurdles just to get fertilization. But what if they do manage to form a zygote?
Then you can run into post-zygotic barriers. The hybrid zygote forms, but something goes wrong after that.
Okay, and Dr. Hoffman described three ways this happens.
Yep. First is reduced hybrid viability. The hybrid offspring might form, but it's frail, doesn't develop properly, or just doesn't survive long.
So it dies young. What if it survives and seems healthy?
That leads to the second barrier, reduced hybrid fertility. The hybrid lives, it might even be strong, but it's sterile.
Like the mule.
Exactly. The classic example Dr. Hoffman gave. A horse and a donkey can produce a mule, which is often a very robust animal, but mules can't reproduce. It's an evolutionary dead end from the BSC perspective.
Because it can't pass on its genes.
Right. And the third one is a bit more subtle. Hybrid breakdown. This is common in plants. The first generation hybrids might be fertile, maybe even the second, but subsequent generations get progressively weaker or sterile. Something just breaks down genetically over time.
Huh. So even if they clear the initial hurdles, the hybrid lineage can still fail later on.
Precisely. And Dr. Hoffman also threw in that curveball, the growler bear, the grizzly polar bear hybrid. They can produce fertile offspring sometimes, but we don't consider them a new species, really highlighting the fuzziness of the BSC.
Man, defining life is tricky. Okay, let's shift gears. How does speciation actually happen? Dr. Hoffman focused on two main modes. First, the more common one, allopatric speciation.
Right. Allo meaning different, patric meaning homeland. So speciation because of geographic separation.
This is the one that seems most intuitive, I think. A population gets split by some physical barrier.
Yeah, like a mountain range rising, a glacier advancing, a river changing course, or even a land bridge forming, like the Isthmus of Panama.
Ah, the Panama example was great. Tell us about the snapping shrimp.
Okay, so when the Isthmus of Panama rose, it separated the Caribbean Sea and the Pacific Ocean, and it also separated populations of marine life, including snapping shrimp.
And Dr. Hoffman said.
He pointed out that today, scientists have found about 15 pairs of snapping shrimp species, where one member of the pair lives in the Atlantic Caribbean, and its closest relative, its sister species, lives in the Pacific. The geology perfectly explains the biology. Clear evidence of allopatric speciation.
That's compelling. And there was a lab experiment, too, with fruit flies.
Yes, the Drosophila experiment. Really elegant. Researchers took a single population of fruit flies and split them into two groups. One group was raised on a starch-based food source, the other on maltose.
Different diets, basically?
Exactly. They let them reproduce for about 40 generations in these separate conditions. Then they put the flies back together.
And what happened?
They found strong mating preferences had developed. Starch-raised flies preferred to mate with other starch-raised flies, and maltose flies preferred maltose flies. They'd started to become reproductively isolated just due to adapting to different food sources in isolation.
Wow, demonstrating speciation beginning in the lab. Okay, so that's allopatric separation. What about the other mode, sympatric speciation?
Right, sim meaning same homeland. This is the trickier one. Speciation happening without geographic isolation. The populations are living side by side.
How does that work? Seems like gene flow would prevent them from diverging.
It does make it harder, which is why it's considered rarer. But Dr. Hoffman described three main mechanisms. First, polyploidy.
Polyploidy.
Yeah.
Multiple chromosome sets.
Exactly. Usually caused by an error during meiosis, cell division for making sperm or eggs. An individual ends up with more than two sets of chromosomes.
And this is more common in plants.
Much more common, yeah. A polyploid organism might instantly become reproductively isolated from the original diploid population. It can lead to autoploidy self-fertilization, creating a new polyploid line, or allopolyploidy hybridization between two different species leads to a fertile polyploid hybrid. It can happen very fast.
Instant speciation, almost. Okay, what? Mechanism two.
Habitat differentiation. This is where subsets of a population start using different resources or parts of the same habitat.
Like the apple maggot flies example Dr. Hoffman gave?
Perfect example. Originally, these flies laid their eggs only on native hawthorn fruits. But then apples were introduced to North America. Some flies started laying eggs on apples instead.
And apples mature earlier than hawthorns.
Right. So the flies specializing on apples experienced selection pressure favoring earlier reproduction to match the apple timing. This led to temporal isolation. They started breeding at slightly different times, even though the trees were right next to each other. Reduced gene flow, leading towards speciation.
Fascinating. All in the same orchard. And the third, sympatric mechanism.
Sexual selection. This is where mate choice drives divergence. The Lake Victoria cichlid fish are the classic case study here.
Ah, yes, the colors.
In clear water, female cichlids choose mates based on specific male coloration. This strong preference keeps different color morphs, which we recognize as different species, reproductively isolated.
But Dr. Hoffman mentioned an experiment.
Yeah, where scientists put them under monochromatic orange light. In that light, the females couldn't tell the colors apart properly, and guess what? They started mating indiscriminately with males of different species. It shows how crucial that visual behavioral cue is for keeping them separate.
Which leads perfectly into hybrid zones, these areas where species do overlap and sometimes interbreed.
Exactly. Dr. Hoffman used the example of the yellow-bellied and fire-bellied toads in Europe. They have a zone where they meet and produce hybrids.
And he laid out three possible fates for these hybrid zones over time.
Right. One possibility is reinforcement. Natural selection strengthens the prezygotic barriers. Hybrids might be less fit, so individuals that avoid interspecies mating have an advantage. The hybrid zone shrinks, and the two species become even more distinct.
Makes sense. What's the opposite?
Fusion. The barriers break down. Gene flow increases between the two groups, and they eventually merge back into a single species. The distinction disappears.
And the third outcome?
Stability. The hybrid zone persists over long periods. Hybrids keep being produced, but the two parent species remain distinct. Maybe the hybrids have some advantage only within that narrow zone, for instance.
Now, the really striking part here connects back to the Lake Victoria fish, right? You mentioned the artificial light experiment leading to indiscriminate mating.
Yes, and Dr. Hoffman pointed out that this is actually happening in nature now in Lake Victoria, but for a different reason, pollution.
Pollution is making the water murky.
Exactly. Increased algae blooms caused by nutrient runoff make the water cloudy. The fish can't see the colors properly anymore, just like under the orange light. So the species barriers are breaking down, and distinct cichlid species are fusing back together because of human environmental impact.
Wow. So fusion isn't just a theoretical outcome. We're actively causing it.
In some cases, yeah. It shows how sensitive these reproductive barriers can be.
Okay, just briefly, Dr. Hoffman also touched on the speed of speciation, the tempo.
Right. Two main models were discussed. The punctuated model, often called punctuated equilibrium, suggests long periods where species don't change much, stasis, interrupted by short bursts of rapid change in speciation.
Quick splits, then stability.
And the gradual model, which is more like Darwin's original idea, suggests slow, steady divergence over long timescales. Dr. Hoffman noted that the fossil record and genetic data actually support both models happening in different lineages and circumstances.
It's not one or the other.
Nope. Nature uses both tempos, and his final point was crucial. Nothing evolves in a vacuum.
Go evolution matters.
Immensely. He used that example of the Louisiana carbonalis flowers. They rely on different pollinators, partly due to their different colors.
And scientists tweaked their genes.
Yeah. They genetically altered the flower color, and boom, the pollinators switched their preferences immediately. It shows how the evolution of one species, the flower color, directly impacts the reproductive isolation potentially driven by another species, the pollinator. Everything is interconnected.
So wrapping this up, the big takeaway from Dr. Hoffman's lecture seems to be that speciation, the creation of life's diversity, isn't always about huge, dramatic events.
Not at all. Sometimes it's incredibly subtle. A tiny chemical mismatch between sperm and egg. A snail shell twisting left instead of right. A behavioral quirk in a mating dance.
Or even, as we saw, murky water caused by pollution blurring the lines that keep species apart.
Exactly. It's a delicate biological process governed by these intricate details and interactions. The barriers can be surprisingly fragile.
Which leaves us with a pretty potent final thought to consider.
Huh.
Dr. Hoffman showed how human activity, like pollution causing fusion in Lake Victoria, can rapidly alter evolutionary trajectories.
Mm-hmm.
So if subtle environmental factors or even genetic signals influence mate choice and reproductive isolation in fish, flies, and flowers, what unseen pressures might be acting on human populations right now? Are environmental changes, social factors, or technology subtly pushing different human groups towards or maybe even away from genetic divergence or fusion in ways we don't even recognize yet?
That's definitely something to chew on. The evolutionary dance continues, even for us.
Indeed it does. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.